Music from Alexander Borden's String Quartet No. 2 in D Major, performed by the Takacs Quartet. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. The quartet and poet Robert Pinsky will perform at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts at the University of Illinois 1 week from tomorrow, January 30th, 2002. The program, titled All the World for Love, is to be an exploration of love. Robert Pinsky is our guest today on the Afternoon Magazine. We'll talk with him about poetry and next week's performance in Urbana. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Robert Pinsky. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana. Our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Robert Pinsky served as U.S. Poet Laureate from 1997 to 2000. He is the author of 6 books of poetry, including The Figured Wheel, New and Collected Poems, 1966 to 1996. That book won the 1997 Lenore Marshall Poetry Prize and was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. His most recent book of poetry is Jersey Rain. Robert Pinsky has also published 4 books of criticism and 2 books of translation. And while he was Poet Laureate, he spearheaded the Favorite Poem Project of the Library of Congress. Together with Maggie Dietz, he edited an anthology of poetry that grew out of that project, the Favorite Poem Project. Pinsky is the poetry editor for Slate, and he teaches at Boston University. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Robert Pinsky, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure to be here, Celeste.
Tell us about the collaboration between yourself and the Takacs Quartet.
We've both enjoyed it a lot. I had heard them and met them very briefly before we began to collaborate, and I was really pleased to discover that I admire these people as people and artists. They are wonderful musicians and very devoted to improving their art, and they're working all the time. It's like being a writer, though they're performers. They are, just as all my poet friends are, always striving to do something better, to excel themselves. So are the Takacs players. And I think the part of our collaboration that we are enjoying on both sides is finding principles in both arts. That in both arts you're trying to get at emotion through technical matters like variations in pitch, subtlety of repetition, how does the repetition vary, little matters of intonation. A lot of the things you do when you write a poem are also things that you're doing when you're thinking about an audience hearing a piece of music.
What's most rewarding for you about performing with the quartet?
Just being on stage with people who are wearing black tie and tails. That's something I've always wanted to do. I suppose, in a way, the most rewarding thing is finding new ways to think about my art.
Uh-huh.
That a piece like the Britten String Quartet No. 3 is not a piece I knew or a piece that I particularly enjoyed the first time I heard it. And I've come to quite love it. I find it just, I just look forward to hearing them play it. And that's the kind of thing that I find makes one be able to do new things in one's own art. If there's a poem or a poet that you didn't know how to read or appreciate, and then you do find out what's good in it, that usually leads to more muscles, as it were, for you as an artist. I find that's even true of an exciting movie or an exciting building. Painting can make you feel you've learned something, and I think that is, for me, probably the most rewarding part of a very pleasurable and exciting collaboration.
Mm. Britten String Quartet No. 3 is one of the pieces on the program. What else is on the program?
First piece that they play is the Janáček Quartet. It's often called the Intimate Letters Quartet. The middle piece, they end with the Britten, the middle piece, is a piece a lot of people know in the context of elegy and grief. It's Samuel Barber's The Adagio from the Barber String Quartet that is very elegiac in most contexts, but it's usually often played by itself. In fact, it turns out that Barber had in mind a passage from Virgil's Georgics where Virgil talks about basically about sexual passion, how it takes over all the animals and the birds and all the people at certain times of year.
And the poetry that's on the program, what's included?
I tried to choose things that I thought sounded wonderful. And as we've refined the program, I've tried to do things that, for a music audience and for a poetry audience in the context of music, poems that call a special attention, perhaps, to things that music and poetry have in common. As I've said, variations in pace, significant pauses and silences and so forth. So I was very aware of sound. And our theme is love. So it's all one way or another, love poetry.
Yeah. Of all the, you know, poetry that's out there that's about love, was it difficult to make a small selection?
Some things, but I saved the contemporary for the end, I read poems by Keats, by Emily Dickinson, by Theodore Rettke. I did a translation of the Virgil passage that I just mentioned, of Philip Sidney, and then we have Louise Glück, Frank Bedard, Alan Dugan, and a poet very few people have heard of, Suzanne Qualls, at the end, and one poem of my own.
And which poem of yours have you selected?
It's a poem that was the title poem of my volume, The Want Bone. And it's a little poem that describes the mouth bones of a shark washed up at a beach. And they're frozen open. They look very voracious. And they're kind of the embodiment of craving or wanting, of empty space that wants to be filled.
Would you recite it for us?
Sure. The Want Bone. The tongue of the waves told in the earth's bell, blue rippled and soaked in the fire of blue. The dried mouth bones of a shark in the hot swale gaped on nothing but sand on either side. The bone tasted of nothing and smelled of nothing, a scalded, toothless harp, uncrushed, unstrung. The joined arcs made the shape of birth and craving, and the welded open shape kept mouthing, oh. Ossified cords held the corners together in grind spirals, pleated like a summer dress. But where was the limber grin, the gash of pleasure? Infinitesimal mouths bored away, the beach scrubbed and etched and pickled it clean. But oh, I love you, it sings, my little, my country, my food, my parent, my child. I want you, my own, my flower, my sin, my life, my lightness, my O.
The Want Bone, Robert Pinsky. There is something immediate about a poem, but then there is also something that you want to think about it, too.
I hope so.
Yeah.
I think the intimacy of poetry makes it different from a lot of the other forms of art we have, television, movies, fiction. have to do with a kind of slow penetration, kind of a gradual absorbing. So, in fact, that is something that is often true of music, too. And chamber music, of course, is, by definition, kind of intimate. If poetry is one voice, then chamber music is, you know, sort of one room, relatively small space.
Yet you'll be performing in a theater, you know, with lots of
chamber
folks.
Musicians do.
Yeah. Does performing, reciting poetry in a theater affect how you approach a reading?
Well, it has to be louder. In a smaller place.
Yeah.
Otherwise, your goal is the same, is to have the meanings of the words and the sounds of the words, the meanings of the sentences and the sounds of the sentences work together to produce an emotion.
How did this collaboration begin? How did you meet these folks and come to say to one another, well, why don't we do something together?
I heard them play here in Boston and talked to Ed Dusenberry briefly, the first violinist. And it grew gradually. I think their agent was involved in mine, and we tried it. Our first performance was in their base, though the name of the quartet and two of the players are Hungarian. They're based in Colorado. So our first performance was in Boulder. The audience seemed to like it very much, and we certainly enjoyed it a lot.
Does this require you to do a lot of traveling?
Yeah, there will be one period on the East Coast. I think it reaches its real fever pitch in the middle of April. We're going to be in, I think it's Atlanta, Lincoln Center, New York, Boston, and Cornell University 4 days in a row in April, 14, 15, 16, 17, something like that. So we may not be as fresh as we are in Urbana. But I hope we'll be discovering new things in the music and in the poetry all the time.
Do you talk about the performances afterward?
We have, and in fact we have changed the program a bit. To my surprise, at the beginning, they encouraged me to read short poems between movements of the Janacek piece, which we did in Boulder and we did again in Pittsburgh. I would have thought that was sacrilege and shouldn't do it. The musicians quite enjoyed it. And at this point in the tour, I guess you'd have to call it, we've decided to back off from that. So they play a piece, I read a set of poems, they play a piece, I read a set of poems, and I no longer read poems between movements of the quartet. It worked better than I thought it would, and there's a kind of montage effect where still thinking about the poem during the music and still thinking about the music during the poem. And that's something that was fun and interesting, though we've taken a more conservative turn.
According to some program notes I've seen, you picked up the saxophone when you were 15. Do you continue to play?
I probably picked it up earlier than that. I started playing probably when I was, I can't remember, I was probably 12 or 13 when I started playing. And about 10 years ago, I went out and bought a horn after having not played for 20 years. And I do play from time to time now, yeah.
Why the saxophone? Why the horn?
Horn means the saxophone. It was certainly in the remote period when I was a youth, the tenor saxophone was the most charismatic and Byronic and romantic of instruments. And can fill a hall. I mean, I mostly played in glorious gigs, you know, the way of weddings and bar mitzvahs, bars, Latin music around the pool at the beach club on weekends. And there was a rhythm section, a piano player, a drummer, and a bass player. And then I was playing the melody. So why the saxophone? Well, it's like being quarterback or something. It seemed very glamorous and very, to me anyway, probably not to anybody else. But it seemed glamorous and really in some ways as being based on breath, rather similar to poetry.
Because poetry requires breath.
The instrument is the voice. Voice in one case, it's breath coming out of the voice box and a mouth in the case of poetry, and it's breath making a reed work a little valve for vibrating air in the reed instrument in the other case.
Do you recall the first poems that took hold of you, or the first poet that you really got caught up?
I could answer a few ways. I certainly loved Stevenson's Child's Garden of Verses when I was very small. I can remember being just electrified by reading Allen Ginsberg when I was in college. I can remember when we memorized Wordsworth's The World is Too Much With Us, Late and Soon, Getting and Spending, certain poems by Hopkins and Keats in high school, feeling thrilled and impressed. It's hard to say which step was the really serious step. At some point when my early teens, late teens, 16, 17 years old, I started reading the poems of Yeats very closely, and it may be that I can remember sailing to Byzantium fascinating me so much that I typed it out and hung it on the wall near where I had breakfast like a picture, sort of stared at it and sort of say, how did he do that? So if I had to choose one, maybe it would be that Yeats poem.
And then when did you begin trying your hand at it? When did you begin writing poetry?
Writing is almost the wrong word, you know. That question is probably most honestly answered by saying that a certain kind of child, maybe even before you learn how to talk, certainly as you learn how to talk, gets very interested by the accidental cadences and echoes in the speech. In fact, accidental cadences starts a little something going with the K's and the S's, accidental cadences. And you'll stop thinking about the meaning of the words for a second. Think accidental cadences, or talking to Celeste about accidental cadences. And the consonant and vowel, the sounds of the consonants and the vowels kind of takes over. And that's probably more crucial than a moment when you write something down. It's that moment when you think, Celeste Quinn, oh, your name slows down at the end. Celeste Quinn, there's an accidental cadence of Celeste Quinn. And that, some people don't know what I'm talking about at all. Many people know exactly what I'm talking about. And say, yeah, I can remember doing that. Thinking about what was the rhythm. What would it suggest that should follow? And, you know, if one of your friends is named, your father's had a friend named Pennybaker or Lobetkin, you just love thinking about the sound of the name Pennybaker or Lobetkin. And the next step, I suppose, is picturing pennies that are baked.
Yeah. Well, there are some things that are just fun to say, and you almost feel drawn to them.
It's a physical process. It's like another child becoming very fascinated by musical sounds and being natural with a mouth organ or a piano, or somebody being from very, very young able to do things with a ball. I'm interested in seeing what a ball could do. I do think there's a physical component to the art of poetry that goes very deep.
And the rhythm of it is comforting. And
comforting or exciting.
And it feels good.
I hope so.
Yeah. I can remember in college reading T.S. Eliot, the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, and loving that repetition of, let's see if I can remember it now, in the room, the women come and go.
Talking of Michelangelo.
Talking of Michelangelo.
Something about the way it sort of is the same. The O comes out a little weaker because it's part of a long word. And the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. It's an almost little tentative, uncertain thing in the Michelangelo part of the rhyme. And there's a comfort and an excitement in it. I don't know if anybody can quite explain it. I can remember from the lecture course in poetry that I wasn't taking in college, I can remember hearing kids in the shower in the dormitory saying, "Let be finale of seem," from Stevens's poem, The Emperor of Ice Cream. And it's maybe a little bit whatever Wallace Stevens means by "let be finale of seem." But it's just fun to say. It's fun to say that beat. It's like your attachment to the rhythm of those Eliot lines. I think that's where poetry starts.
Talk with us, if you would now, about the favorite poem project, which you spearheaded when you were poet laureate. What a wonderful thing that has been. You must be pleased with the project. I have the anthology here with me, and it is... it's really wonderful.
I urge you, Celeste, and your listeners to go to the website at favoritepoem.org, where you can see the videos. Many of them have been shown on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. We showed one last night for Martin Luther King Day. And you can see Pov Chin, a Cambodian immigrant kid, reading a poem by Langston Hughes. John Doherty, a Boston Gas construction worker, reading Walt Whitman. They talk about why they like Whitman or use this poem. And the attachment that you and I have been talking about in relation to your attachment to the Eliot lines, the way I felt when I read Sailing to Byzantium, you can hear it in people's voices as they read poems they like. And I am delighted to say that the project goes on. Got a grant from the Carnegie Foundation that's going to let us put the package of videos into rural libraries. I hope to get them into schools. And Norton is doing a second book, as well as that book that you have. Another one is going to come out in April. And these books, they combine the interest of poetry and the interest of gossip. You have the poems, and then you have quotations from the letters that people wrote to the project about the poems and the significance and personal value that they found in the poem.
Mm-hmm. And those are really moving. I was fascinated by those.
Yeah. Do you feel like telling me some of the specific ones that you are talking about?
Well, let's go right to the first one. And there's so much here. I think that there are how many, 200 poems here?
Something like that, yes.
Yeah, so I've only had this book in my hands for a couple of days. The very first one, the sentence, this is the poem that Nancy
Nersessian. Yeah, she's also in one of the videos. If you go to Akhmatova, you can see Nancy talking about this.
Yeah.
Should I read what she says? Or should you?
Yeah, please.
Nancy Nersessian, 51, professor of cognitive science, Atlanta, Georgia. She wrote, "This poem is very meaningful to me because when I first read it in the late 1970s, it struck me very forcefully as capturing the struggle my brother faced with all the other traumatized Vietnam vets. In 1969, my brother David was commissioned at the age of 19 as an officer in the Green Beret in Fort Benning, Georgia. He was the youngest commissioned officer they had ever had. He was smart, he was funny, he was full of promise. He had planned a military career and volunteered for Vietnam. In that year before going, he married his childhood sweetheart and they had a son. He shipped out for Vietnam in January 1970, and after a year in continuous combat, he returned home a highly decorated war hero and a broken man of 21. By the time I read this poem, I realized, the realization had sunk in, that this was my brother's life. My brother was never going to learn to live again, because the struggle was too hard." And the poem is The Sentence by Anna Akhmatova, translated in this version by Judith Hemschemeyer. The sentence: "And the stone word fell on my still living breast. Never mind. I was ready. I will manage somehow. Today I have so much to do. I must kill memory once and for all. I must turn my soul to stone. I must learn to live again. Unless summer's ardent rustling is It's like a festival outside my window. For a long time, I've foreseen this brilliant day. Deserted house.
Very powerful poem about war in this case.
Getting used to loss.
Yeah. Brilliant day. Deserted house.
Brilliant day, deserted house. Pretty good for four words.
Mm-hmm. This project, it seems to me, is something that should continue or should be revisited from time to time, don't you think?
I agree. I'm happy to say that favorite poem readings are still taking place all around the country. And videos are being used in schools. I hope they'll be used in more schools. And maybe someday there'll be some more production of the videos as well.
Is there an audio?
There is.
Version of these, okay, readings?
Yes, there is. And I suppose those should be distributed someday, too. Right now we're concentrating on the video. In fact, there's a larger number of audio recordings, and they're edited differently. They're edited for audio, and we have broadcast-quality tapes that have different editing process. The stage the project is at right now is really finding distribution for the product that we've made.
So
people will hear them and see them, do like them very much.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can remember in school really loving to hear poets. You know, the teacher would put on an LP, record.
Part of those old Cadman recordings.
Yes. Oh, exactly. And that was fabulous. And so
yep.
I really look forward to listening to these poems. Likewise, I've just discovered that the poetry that you provide for Slate is also audio. I mean,
you can hear it. Sound card in your computer, which nearly everyone does now. You can click on the poem and hear the poet read the poem. So you hear Seamus Heaney or Louise Glick or whoever the contributor is that week read the poem aloud.
How do you select those poems?
Like any other poetry editor, people submit things. Once in a while, I put in something by a dead poet, and if it's a poem by Emily Dickinson or Elizabeth Bishop or Gerard Manley Hopkins, then I read it aloud. And I try to pick things. It's like the answer to the question of what did we choose for the talk. I should try to pick things I think just sound terrific.
The work of choosing the poems for Americans' Favorite Poems from the Favorite Poem Project had to be really a daunting task.
Many thousands of letters,
yeah.
And they were quite wonderful. And we did some demographic winnowing. You know, we knew we wanted to represent every state in the union. And we wanted a wide range of poems and readers, but it was hard. And the criterion that I kept to as we were winnowing through so many thousands of letters was the interest and intensity of the relationship between the person and the poem. As in that Nancy Narcissian letter, what she has to say about her brother and about the poem. The poem illuminates the story about the brother, and I think his story makes us understand why the poem is important to her.
There's another poem that I was struck by, and maybe we could talk about it.
Sure.
This is a Turkish poet, Nazım Hikmet.
Hikmet, yes.
Things I Didn't Know I Loved. Mm-hmm. And this was chosen by a young man, Chad Menville, 24 years old, student, New York City.
Yes.
I identify with this poem about imprisonment, censorship, longing, and belief in oneself more than with any other poem I have read. This poem needs to be heard!
Yes.
Please.
Yeah. It's wonderful when you feel the connection between the person and the poem goes deeper than any stereotype. You know, this is a poem from somebody who's Turkish or... young man doesn't say anything about being in prison. something clicked for him. Mm-hmm. Something happened that made him love this particular poem. There's a wonderful set of letters about Robert Hayden's poem, Those Winter Sundays, where you get people of all sorts of different ages talking about their fathers, because it's a poem which Hayden talks very movingly about his father's way of expressing love, not at all overtly. And the letters had a lot of interest. We have Shakespeare sonnets commented on by this one where an 80-year-old man talks about the sonnet in relation to his being in an orphanage when he was a kid and how happy he was, his heart arising like the lark at break of day when he realized he was going to be with his father again. And there's a letter about a Shakespeare sonnet from a young girl, you know, 11-year-old girl, thinks how great it would be to have a handsome young man recite this poem to me someday.
There's tremendous variety in the poetry in the anthology. Shakespeare, T.S. Eliot, Gwendolyn Brooks, Lewis.
Why don't we read that Robert Hayden poem?
Okay.
Those Winter Sundays by Robert Hayden. Sundays, too, my father got up early and put his clothes on in the blue-black cold. Then, with cracked hands that ached from labor in the weekday weather, made banked fires blaze. No one ever thanked him. I'd wake and hear the cold splintering, breaking. When the rooms were warm, he'd call, and slowly I would rise and dress, fearing the chronic angers of that house, speaking indifferently to him who had driven out the cold and polished my good shoes as well. What did I know? What did I know of love's austere and lonely offices?
I wonder, were there poems that came from readers that surprised you? Were you introduced to someone's work as a result of this project?
Oh, yeah, quite a few. I'm not sure I knew that Hikmet poem. I certainly hadn't read it in a long time. There's that translation from Archilochus by Kenneth Rixroth, a little 10 lines thing that I thought was just wonderful and I had never encountered before. I had not read the Julia de Burgos poem. Just repeatedly, yeah. Poems that I either didn't know at all or that were poems I'd sort of forgotten about or never quite noticed.
Hmm.
It was a great side benefit for me of doing the project.
Yeah. Was it difficult to give up the post as poet laureate?
No.
No?
All the things that were really important that I did then, by far the main one was the favorite poem project. I still do. And no, it was not a great landmark dividing point in my life.
Hmm. I would imagine, though, in the course of that time as poet laureate, you got to meet so many people and hear them talk about poetry.
Yes.
That had to have been a wonderful experience for you.
That's true, but I'm sure that's going to happen to me as it's already happened to me as I travel around with the Takahashi as well.
Yeah. Will there be other programs that you'll do with the string quartet?
Well, we're doing this program, and maybe we'll refine and hone it as we go around. Maybe we'll change. But we're going to do this. I think Urbana is, we did it 3 or 4 times in the, we did it in the fall. And we've had a hiatus of a couple of months. And between now and the spring, we're probably going to do it 12 times. And it'll be, for Urbana is pretty much the first of this next leg of things. And we'll see how we feel about it.
Mm.
We'll see how we feel after we've done it and how audiences feel. So far, I think we did it in Atlanta, Pittsburgh, and Boulder. I may be leaving one more out. The response, the reviews were very good, and the audiences seemed quite happy. We'll see. We'll see after we finish this tour.
Mm. Poet Robert Pinsky is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He will perform at the Kranert Center for the Performing Arts at the University of Illinois 1 week from tomorrow, January 30th, 2002. He will perform with the Takach Quartet, String Quartet. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener who's waiting for us on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Is this for me?
That's you.
Hi.
You're on the air.
I'd like to, with reference to the ideas of evil, I'm thinking of this. I have a poem here, one of my favorite American poems I'd like to read by Edgar Lee Masters.
Mm-hmm.
This fellow, the town librarian, is really dead. The evil of plutocracy, although this is just about evil per se. The lament of Seth Compton from his grave. When I died, the circulating library, which I built up for Spoon River and managed for the good of inquiring minds, was sold at auction on the public square. As if to destroy the last vestige of my memory and influence. For those of you who cannot see the virtue of knowing Volney's runes, as well as Butler's analogy, and Faust, as well as Evangeline, were really the power in the village, that often you asked me, what is the use of knowing the evil in the world? I am out of your way now. Spoon River, choose your own good and call it good, for I could never make you see that no one knows what is good who knows not what is evil. And no one knows what is true. Who knows not what is false?
Wonderful. Masters like Robinson, like E.A. Robinson, is very good at small town invectives taking on a kind of heroic quality. He found it. Probably a somewhat autobiographical poem, his idea of this relationship to his own culture. He's the circulating library he established. They sold it. They want to know about good and evil. Terrific.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and we're going to go and talk with another listener who's waiting for us on line one in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
And I can barely hear you. Well, Mr. Pinsky was talking about looking for a distribution for the videos, and I wondered if they had contacted the Consortium of College and University Media Centers, which, if it will not distribute them, will certainly know some kind of lead.
Good idea. If you don't mind, there's an email address on the website at favoritepoem.org. Tell us about that, and we'll follow it up.
Well, I don't have email.
I'm
one of the older generation, and
okay, the Consortium of College
and
Media
University.
You're an impressive person because you know about the Consortium of College and University Media Centers, but you don't go for the computer and email.
Well, I just bought one, and I haven't got it connected yet. The headquarters is at Ames, Iowa, at the University, Iowa State University.
Well, thank you for the information.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments, they are welcome. 333-9455. Anywhere else outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. The poetry for Slate, has poetry been part of Slate since the beginning of the honor?
The very first issue of Slate had a poem by Seamus Heaney in it, and I think maybe there's been one or two exceptions, but every issue of the weekly has had a poem in it.
And from the outset, was the idea that there would be an audio component?
Yes, there's been an audio component from the beginning. And another nice aspect of publishing and reading poetry on an internet magazine like Slate is that all the poems you've ever published are still available. Go into the archives, and you can hear and read poems from all the years the magazine has existed. fish. But in the on the web, it's always there.
Yeah. Well, with that and favoritepoem.org, those are two really good sites for poetry lovers. Are there other spots out there in cyberspace that...
Oh, there are a lot of poetry sites. The Academy of American Poets runs a good one, and I think they have links to a lot of others. And there are a lot of online magazines that are devoted mainly to poetry. There are also these sites where people post their own poems, sometimes lots of different authors. There's a Poem a Day site. So there's partly, I think, compared to the novel, the lyric poem is very well suited to the format of the computer. Mm-hmm. So you can fit a lot of a poem or most of a poem onto the screen.
Mm-hmm. And you can have a poetry reading with people from around the world.
That's right.
On the web.
There's a wonderful, if I can suggest another one of the favorite poem readings at favoritepoem.org, there's Sylvia Plath poem that's read by a man named Seth Rodney, and he just gives you a model of how to read a poem aloud. He's a photographer, Jamaican guy.
Huh.
He comments on the fact that he's from Jamaica. They're different. He and Plath are different ages, religions, races, etc. He says, but her poems speak to him.
And also it seems to me that you don't have to be, because you're a poet or you're a photographer or you're a painter or you play the violin, all these things, if you're an artist and are sensitive and open to those things, all those will all influence you. Art will find you, or you will find art.
I mean, art may have been produced by very aristocratic and hierarchical societies, but the truth is that it's available to a lot of people, and you don't have to be rich or socially powerful to have access to the greatest writing ever. And W.E. Du Bois has a wonderful passage at the end of one of his essays when he says, "I summon Shakespeare," and he winces not. You know, that the reader has access to in poetry to the kind of intimate contact with great work that only a very, very small number of people have with, say, painting. You actually have marvelous paintings in a private collection, but Yeats and Dickinson and Shakespeare do come in when you summon them.
We're right at the end here. I was wondering if there might be one other poem you'd like to share with us this afternoon before we have to say goodbye.
I'll read the first poem in my recent book, Jersey Rain. Samurai Song. Samurai Song. When I had no roof, I made audacity my roof. When I had no supper, my eyes dined. When I had no eyes, I listened. When I had no ears, I thought. When I had no thought, I waited. When I had no father, I made care my father. When I had no mother, I embraced order. When I had no friend, I made quiet my friend. When I had no enemy, I opposed my body. When I had no temple, I made my voice my temple. I have no priest. My tongue is my choir. When I have no means, fortune is my means. When I have nothing, death will be my fortune. Need is my tactic. Detachment is my strategy. When I had no lover, I courted my sleep.
Samurai Song. In this volume of poetry, there is a lot of the heroic, there's a lot of myth here. Care to make any comment on
that? I've always been interested by knights and heroes, and I've always found them absurd and appealing and admirable.
Yeah.
And the idea of important, powerful idea to me, as well as something possible to be mocked or be ironic about. It's a very powerful idea in both ways. And when I was a little boy, I used to like the idea of people who rode around on horses in armor and had swords.
Yeah, well, I want to say goodbye. We're out of time, but I also want, I hope people will go look for Jersey Rain and go look up a phone book cover, a phone book cover, Hermes of the 1940s.
A pleasure talking to you, Celeste.
Thank you very much. Robert Pinsky has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book of poetry is Jersey Rain.